everybody, and welcome to the PC Perspective Podcast. This is episode 260, being recorded on July 17th, 2013. I'm Ryan Schrout.
I'm Jeremy Hellstrom.
I'm Josh Walrath.
And I'm Mari Tattleman.
Alan is somewhere else. It doesn't really matter.
He sucks.
He'll be back somewhere some other time.
Yeah, you go to England, he goes someplace else, and what do?
I'm going.
He's at an unspecified location in the Mediterranean.
I'm going to a beach next week, too. What do you think about that?
Did you rub it in a little?
Okay, how about this? I'm going with 16 family members.
Are they cute?
I mean, my wife is, but other than that, if they're under 12, they're monsters. And if they're
just
over 12,
as long as you don't do a confession bear about the experience, you'll be fine.
We'll see. Yeah. Did you hear that? That the Pope is now doing confessions over Twitter.
It's not a joke, that's for real. The 1200s, and they kind of got smacked around. It wasn't Twitter at the time, but you can forgive your sins if you pay some money.
Yeah, that was a sword and a cross, so Josh, it's a little different.
So what's wrong with your face, Josh?
I lost my glasses this weekend.
Lost them?
I lost them.
You misplaced them?
Yes, I did.
Can you see what's happening on the show?
Yes, I can. My eyesight is not that bad.
Okay, I'm gonna randomly hold up fingers throughout the show.
Which one it'll be.
Well, maybe it's not just one. Maybe the idea is we got to get him to count.
He can't count.
It's not the vision. It's the counting part. Fair enough. Let's talk about hardware because that's what we do on this show. This is the podcast from PC Perspective, the most amazing website in the world. And it's PCPro.com. We review hardware and gadgets and toys, mainly just hardware and things like that. So let's talk about some of them. We'll talk about reviews, news, whatever. Maury, save us here. You reviewed the Gigabyte Z87X OC Force motherboard. And because of that nomenclature, I expect it to be a very substantial product. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that board, it was actually a very impressive board. It was one of the more impressive of the Z87s I have looked at yet. If I had a choice of what board I would put in my system, that would be the board I'd put in my system. It's got some of the highlights. It has both air-cooled and water-cooling barbs on the CPU VRMs. It has also air-cooling on the Southbridge but the chipset. And the PLX chip, the rear panel has dual Intel NICs, and I believe that they're server class NICs. It's got a total of 5 PCI Express slots, X16 style. That's why it has a PLX chip. Black one, the way that they did it with the 5 is black. The black PCIe slot actually goes directly to the CPU, so it bypasses the PLX at all. So if you're using single card mode, you use that. If any cards are in any of the orange slots, the black slot is automatically disabled. The PLX chip controls the orange slots. The first two orange slots are X16, and the second two are X8. So it's got a lot of power. What else? It's got it's got like 16 phase power on it. You know, ASUS has adamantly said on multiple occasions that you don't need more than 8 with the Haswells because they put so much of the VRM control stuff into Haswell.
Right.
You know, this is a contender for an editor for at least a gold award, if not editor's choice. I'm currently running the overclocking and the more depth testing on this board right now. It's doing really well. Just a preview of that, I was able to get it to boot stably at a 175 base clock speed. I think the CPU was running about 4.6, which is very good for a Haswell with moderate water cooling. I was using a Corsair H100 cooler on that because I'm having some issues with my custom-built water cooler stabilizing temperatures.
What are all these buttons here? I'm looking at this picture in the review. There's a lightning bolt. There's a tag button. There's a turbo button. There's a power button. There's plus and minus gear, and then plus and minus.
Yes. Okay. The lightning bolt actually allows you to power the board without power, without actually turning on the system. So you can power your fans, your drives, everything else without actually turning on the CPU.
So this will allow you to run like LED lights, fans, yep, water pumps without powering on actual components. So if you do build a demo system or you have a system you want to show off at like QuakeCon or something like that, you would hit that button instead of the power button. You could run it that way, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and Ryan wants to know where the Beat Small Children button is.
To either allow the system to warm up or to let the cooling system cool down without having to worry about it shutting off when the computer shuts off. Because a lot of those LN2 systems, you need to give it cool down time before you actually turn it off after you turn off the system.
Gotcha.
Or heat up time. Let's see. Back to that.
I like the design, the color, kind of the lines around on the heat sinks and stuff around the CPU socket. I like. I think the board looks really good.
The one disappointing thing that I came up with, and again, this isn't in the review that's up right now. It'll be on the future review. Is that the heat pipe system is actually two different heat pipes. There are two different disconnected heat pipes. The PLX and chipset are on one, and the CPU VRMs on the other. And the water cooling only cools the CPU VRMs. It's a very odd design, in my opinion, because the PLX and the chipset are actually the big heat producers on this board. But both heat pipe systems have active cooling with them. They both have integrated 40 millimeter fans that are dead silent. So it's still a very nice design.
Okay.
I mean, all those buttons, though, you can control basically. Those are all base clock. Those are all onboard overclocking stuff. You know, you can load custom profiles. You can change your base clock. You can change your ratio. It's very geared towards high-end competition level water cooling in LN2. You know, that's what this board is made for.
All right.
It's got a lot of SATA ports on it. It's got a good mix of everything, and it's got a lot of space on it because it's actually an eATX board, which means that it's the same width as an ATX board, from right to left, it's the same length, right, as a normal ATX board, but from front to back, which would be from the rear panel to where the dim slots are, it's about an inch and a half to 2 inches longer. So that's how they can fit all that stuff on there without really sacrificing on any spacing or anything like that.
Now, in terms of the BIOS and that kind of stuff, have we already looked at a Gigabyte Z87 review before?
We have. The BIOS, it uses the what they're calling the dual BIOS. It's very similar in nature to their old 3D BIOS, but it actually takes it a step further. It has two different modes. It's got something called Windows mode, which basically is you can go through everything and point and click everything. It has a favorites menu. It's got a right click shortcut menu. You can also go into classic mode, which is just their normal BIOS. Both are good. There were some slight hiccups with the mouse support that I saw. Sometimes you'd go in and the mouse would actually be in unaccelerated mode, which means you'd move the mouse, it would go about a centimeter. That was intermittent, and if you rebooted the system, usually it would revert. It was a minor issue, really. I actually got the one problem I had with the previous board was I could not get it in HD mode because Windows mode actually supports a 1080p viewing mode, and I was finally able to find a post online to figure out that gave me some hints. Figure out how to get it into HD mode. Unfortunately, with HD mode, I could only get it to work over the HDMI plug for the onboard CPU video. I could not get it to work through a discrete card. So,
interesting. Okay.
But I do have a screenshot of HD mode up there. It's pretty cool because they basically take the middle screen with BIOS settings and keep that intact, but all around it you have settings like temperatures, voltages, fan speeds, all that stuff. It's very cool.
So this part in the middle is what you would get normally. And then on the right side here, you can get like system status information. You get your BIOS ID, CPU ID, CPU status, memory status. That is kind of cool. I like that.
And I mean the coloration of it's nice. It keeps with the coloration of the board. The black and orange. it's a really nice board. It is a very valid contender with the ASUS Maximus 6 Extreme. That's what they were going for.
What about in terms of pricing and that kind of stuff? How does this relate to some of the other Z87 boards?
This is the top of the line. I mean, this is like somewhere between, I think it's between $400 and $450, I think, which for a flagship board, that's about normal. For an LN2 competition board, that's what you'd expect.
Really? Okay.
Because that's same pricing as Maximus 6 Extreme, probably that ECS Gank Buster board, whatever.
I forget what that was called.
The Gank Machine.
Gank Bank.
I think the X Power, which is the MSI, actually, I have that too. This guy here is also, you know, that's MSI's version of the OC4, so it'll be coming up
soon. Looks like an X-Men box to me.
Yeah, they like their X.
All right, well, that's pretty cool. Check out, so you have another kind of follow-up review on several of these Z87 motherboards coming up pretty soon as well, so you guys can look forward to that. Otherwise, check out the full article up at PCPro.com right now. A couple of other things that went up this week from me. We looked at the Lenovo Idea Center Horizon table PC, and this is a 27-inch table PC. We first saw it at CES in January out in Las Vegas, and Lenovo was bragging about it as a PC designed for not just multi-touch but for multi-user environments. So it's an all-in-one PC. You can see here it's got a kickstand. It folds down completely flat. It's built on Ivy Bridge. It's not a Haswell design or anything like that. It's built on Ivy Bridge. It has a discrete GPU in there, but nothing to write home about. I think it's like a GT620M. It's fairly moderate I/O, two USB and HDMI input, not an output, an HDMI input, SD card, audio connections, that kind of stuff. It has a really kind of not very good keyboard and mouse. The interesting part is the software that they built called Aura, that when you fold the machine completely flat, kind of presents itself in a multi-user environment so that you can look at photos and play games and do stuff like that. We did a video kind of overview of this device, and let me kind of see if I can scrub through here to some of the part where we're actually utilizing Aura, and you can kind of get an idea on the video version. The most important application on this device is, of course, the integrated copy of Monopoly. And really nothing...
Let's play Monopoly!
Nothing is more important...
Does it still say that?
I don't think it does.
Damn it.
Nothing is more important than Monopoly in this, as far as I'm concerned.
Except getting the car first.
Well, yeah, you got to get the car. If you're not the car, you just power off the machine and you
What's
go home.
Wrong with the battleship? I'm serious.
So... what's interesting now is you don't have to pack up the board and go home. You can just hit the power button of the machine, lift it up, and take it with you,
and throw it on the ground.
So there's no app to actually throw the board at the opponent.
No, there's no function for that. It does have a battery on this device as well. It only lasts probably about 2 hours, maybe a little bit less. So not really a portable device. It weighs 18 pounds and it's a 27-inch monitor, but it's interesting that you can kind of move it around the house from place to place. If it's in your den and you want to take it into the kitchen while you're doing something else, you can absolutely do that. If you want the kids to take it onto in the living room and lay it on the floor and play something, you know, they can do that. So the Aura interface is interesting. It has some really bad software that comes with it, like this. So here, what a perfect game, right? Texas Hold'em. Good four-person game. You implement it that way, except this one, they like, I don't know how else to say this without being really crude, but they like Japanese-ed it or something. It's like, it's got these little Chinese characters and these like anime characters, and they're very much like, they do things like you can spend heart points and look under and change the hold card of the person to your right. And like little sparkly things happen when you do that, and you can you can send love to somebody, and then you can it's very like,
oh, you and me so karate.
Yeah, it's not good. And then like air hockey, it's kind of interesting.
Okay, going back, how do you check your cards without everybody else seeing them?
Let me see.
You put your hand over it.
You put your hand over it, you put your hand over it, and you kind of like draw the cards back. And you actually, like, it actually shows you the corner of the cards.
Wow.
So it's actually kind of cool. Like it could have been interesting to play. I would have been excited to try this with some buddies and see how it actually works out. But I'm not playing that kind of poker with anybody.
With your buddies.
With my buddies, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Air hockey is okay. It comes with these little accessories, like these little, what do they call them?
I don't Pucks?
Know. No, the puck is the thing that's bouncing around. I don't know, paddles, I guess we'll call it. And they're touch sensitive, like they have things in the bottom of them so that you can, you know, it recognizes what they are and it kind of moves around. But there's a little bit of a latency, there's a lag behind it. It's not very good, in my opinion. And then they have another game here where you can have these two joysticks that have suction cups that attach to the screen, and then they have like little contacts on either side of it, and you can move it around. That actually works quite a bit better, but the game that was on there for demoing it was not the best, in my opinion, either. It was not awful. It's, you know, Android style, iOS style, iOS style gaming.
Okay, but you remember 2 years ago, Ryan, when this first sort of oversized tactile interface came out. You remember that Star Wars game that we saw?
On the big wall screen?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not
enough. What happened to that?
Got me. Right, so the issue I have with this is I think the form factor is interesting. I think the idea of having a table PC is really interesting, one that kind of folds flat. But the problem is the software ecosystem, right? Do you really trust Lenovo to push companies like Ubisoft and EA to make a bunch of these games? Like, I don't know. I bet they had to do a lot of work to get a specific Monopoly version made and a specific version of whatever that Raiders game was and stuff to work.
But it probably didn't come with Scrabble, did it?
It didn't come with Scrabble. Like, see, like, all there's all these board game adaptions that would be great for this. And I just don't have any faith that the software ecosystem will continue to evolve. And considering that this PC, even though it's Ivy Bridge based, it's got decent performance. If you look at like the benchmarks we have here, it's okay. It's about on line with like a Trinity based laptop or any of the kind of Ivy Bridge low end ultrabooks. It does okay in performance. But you're paying, this is $1,600, I think, for this device, and it doesn't come with an SSD. It's got 750 gig traditional hard drive. There's some other, you know, the screen is really, really glossy, which means when you're laying it flat, the potential for glare is pretty overwhelming. And, you know, when it's laying flat, like now it's not, you can't like turn it or whatever. It's every light source in that room is going to be affecting it.
Spill a few beer on it, it'll start to fade a bit.
Yeah. So, like, my conclusion was, like, the most fun I had with this was definitely playing Monopoly. And it was like, this is cool. This is how you – a new way to interface with things. The capability of looking at photos and sharing photos and videos is intriguing, I guess. But it's not something that I would ever really do. It doesn't have implementation with stuff like Facebook. Like, if you could have it where, you know, this is the table PC – my wife has her Facebook account. I have my Facebook account. We can both kind of like look through our stuff and like share pictures back and forth that way. That's kind of interesting. But, you know, just to say, well, this can search your hard drive for photos and then it can present them to you in this kind of odd Aura interface doesn't really do much for me. So I would love to love this device, but I don't really love it. You know, if there were Scrabble, if there were what was the other one? Like you said Battleship, and you were talking about the Monopoly toy. I'm thinking about the game Battleship. I guess you couldn't really hide the other side of the screen from anybody. But
it would be kind of hard. No,
yeah.
Cardboard.
Just put a sheet or something right down the middle.
Now, Stratego.
Risk yeah. would have, yeah. Risk could be another one. I mean, it's there's a lot of cool ideas for this, but until I see a lot more like software take advantage of it, it's hard to go with the up price. Here's the most interesting thing we did all week, though. We got in that Asus PQ321Q 4K monitor. It's 31 and
because
a half.
Because I spammed Twitter like nobody's business.
Josh registered 40 accounts. And registered. So, yes, we have our podcast listeners and our Twitter followers to thank. Asus did end up sending us one of the first PQ321 displays, 31.5-inch 4K monitors. FedEx literally dropped it off at our offices. There was a hole in the box.
Did they throw it over the fence?
No, they did not throw it over the fence.
It sure as hell looked like it.
No.
They just kicked it a bit.
So it's a $3,500 4K display. I'm working on an article. Hopefully it'll be up maybe this weekend, maybe on Monday or so. that looks at kind of like my first experiences with it, what my impressions are, what the additional DPI can actually do for you as a user. I don't think we're going to be able to do a lot of gaming testing yet just because of some complications with dual HDMI mode inputs. So we're working on that. But we did post, if you go to the website, is a hour and a half or so of our initial unboxing, kind of walking through the product. Here's how the menus work. Here's how the settings work. Here's us hooking up to an AMD system. Here's us hooking it up to an NVIDIA system. What's that setup like? So for it's interesting for AMD, you're actually just – you hook up a – so the reason this monitor is special is because it does 4K at 60 hertz, right? We had a 50-inch Seiki TV that does 4K at 30 hertz over a single HDMI connection. This uses a DisplayPort MST connection to do 3840 by 2160 at 60 hertz. And MST, for you, those who you don't know, and I was just learning about this as well, is multi-stream transport. It is the capability for one cable to carry multiple display streams to a display, from a graphics card to a display, a multi-head display, a tiled display that then has those two signals, knows what to do with them, and displays them on the left and right side of a monitor. Or maybe eventually, you know, upper left, lower left, upper right, lower right. So now you've got four tiles in that display. And for AMD, setup was really just hook up this DisplayPort cable, hook it up to the graphics card, you boot it up. It sees it as two monitors. And you go through the Eyefinity configuration, the Eyefinity setup, and you say it's a two-screen, 2x1, this is my left, this is my right, boom, you're up and running, and things are good. With NVIDIA, that's not the case. As of today, as we record this, there was no publicly available driver that was supported 2x1 surround. And in fact, the drivers in this particular case still do not globally support 2x1 surround. They kind of make a special case for supporting the Sharp monitor and this Asus monitor that are kind of based on the same platform. So there are some other bugs with NVIDIA, like I never got it to boot with a cold boot. If you have this monitor connected, the postcode would stop on our motherboard and you'd hit a soft reset and it would reboot back up into Windows and it would just work. The monitor does support SST single stream transport. If you want to do that, you want to run 4K at 30 hertz. But what's interesting about that is that it has some different positives and negatives. When you're running in MST mode, for example, it appears, I've got some questions in with all the relevant vendors, Asus and AMD and NVIDIA, that if you're running in MST mode, 4K at 60 hertz while you're on the desktop, but you don't have enough graphics horsepower to game at 4K, say you want to game at 19 by 10 and just, you know, have it upscale on the monitor, it doesn't work. It only wants to show that on one half of the screen. And that's obviously a kind of a big deal for people that don't want to buy $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 worth of graphics cards quite yet, but they're willing to buy this for like the productivity implications that you get on this monitor. Watching 4K video on it was astounding. We had watched 4K video on the Seiki and I was pretty impressed, but nothing impressed me more than the puppies video this time around, running it at 60 hertz. It was actually really, really impressive. It's not a gloss screen. It's a matte screen finish, which I think makes a pretty big difference. In my opinion, of the overall quality and experience you have on the display. And then in that video, we also threw in three Titan graphics cards and decided to do some gaming with mostly positive results. I'm trying to find a spot here. We did some Battlefield. We did some Skyrim. We did Metro. So, yeah, there's a lot left to talk about with this. And, you know, since we're never going to give the monitor back to Asus or anything like that, there's plenty of time for us to talk about it. I've had a lot of Twitter discussion back and forth with people about, do you need anti-aliasing when you're using a monitor like this? And it's a very interesting question. Me and Josh and Scott and some other guys were talking in our internal company chat earlier today about all the math that goes in, whether or not that could be doable. Can we test it in any kind of way using a camera to emulate your human eye and its angle and its distance and that kind of stuff. And it's very complex discussion. It's not something I think I'll be able to do, at least not right away. I've also started taking...
Unless we send all our viewers 4K monitors so they can actually physically see the difference.
Not going to do that. You can ask Asus. Maybe I could bring it to QuakeCon and Not going to do that, actually.
Get it stolen. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to.
Someone puts their fist through a 4K monitor just because they can.
Yeah, his name is Josh, and he's had some beer.
He's looking for his glasses.
I was. I couldn't see so good. I didn't have my glasses with me.
But watching Skyrim and this puppy video again was really, really impressive. Even watching it on the stream coming through, like the color.
You're not looking at the puppy.
No, I'm looking at the puppy. Anyway, check out that video, that preview that we posted, and hopefully in the next handful of days I'll have another article up that kind of talks about experiences with it. What the drivers do and don't do, what the firmware updates do and won't do, and we'll kind of leave performance for another day. In reality, we already did 4K testing with our Seiki, and even though it was on a 30 hertz panel, in theory, performance isn't going to change, right? Because you're still rendering, you know, you're not like, we weren't running it with VSync on, it wasn't capping it at 30 frames per second. So there are still some performance implications to get into, but we've already kind of done some of our 4K testing. So be jealous of that, but know that we're working hard to produce content with it, not just use it all the time. Maybe. Kind of. I guess as a short preview, I don't know if we're going to have time to do anything with it Friday when it comes in, but I'm going to have that 39-inch Seiki 4K TV.
I thought that one was going to me.
It's not going to Ken's house. I'm sorry, Ken.
Yes,
no.
You're going on
Ken says I'm going on vacation, so if the 4K displays happen to disappear, that's not him. So we might be able to do something with that. I don't know. We'll see. It depends on when it actually shows up, and I need to leave Saturday morning for a road trip. So,
how much is the Seiki monitor going to go for, the 39-inch?
The 39-inch is $599? $599 or $699?
That's it?
Yeah.
That's not bad.
So keep in mind, it is a 30 hertz panel still. Let me see. It could be awesome. So yeah, here it is on Amazon. $699. And I don't know how it has 28 reviews already. I guess it is shipping. Yeah, it's in stock, it says. So you can buy this.
Oh, it's 120 hertz?
It's 120 hertz when it's in 1080p mode.
Ah, that right? makes a lot of sense.
So it's crappy branding, marketing, or whatever you want to call it, right? But I was impressed. Seiki was, they saw our coverage of the 50-inch, and they actually, you know, contacted us about the 39-inch. So they're paying attention. They're interested. You can actually get the 50-inch for $960.
Wow.
Available in stock, shipping today. Right? I mean, that's pretty awesome.
High speed, low drag.
Yeah,
words and stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Finally, the last review that went up this week, it was kind of a slow week for us. I blame everybody else on this podcast, was I posted an article on the Galaxy GeForce GTX 770 GC. The 770, as you will recall, is a GK104 part. It's running at higher clocks, higher memory speed, still available in 2 or 4 gig iterations. This is a 2 gig iteration. I think you said something earlier this week to me, Josh, about 4 gigs were starting to show up.
Yeah, I think, MSI? Well, we can get into that later, I believe. But okay. No, I guess it's not listed. But MSI, they're starting to ship their 4 gig 770s.
Right. So this Galaxy One is overclocked. It's running at 1.111 gigahertz clock speed, or 1,111 megahertz base boost speed of 1163. Memory speed still sitting pretty at 1753, aka 7 gigatexels. Gigahertz. Gigahertz.
What are you talking about?
There's another term.
The gigas.
You know, the things.
I want the bigger GBs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a 6.5 to 7% increase in your frequency compared to the stock speed. So you can expect anywhere from 5 to 7% performance boost with this card in games that are kind of GPU limited, and we actually saw that fairly often. The cooler this is not a reference design. It's using a custom cooler. It's using a custom PCB. It's using dual fan configuration. They say they're designed the fans to minimize noise during operation. The shroud itself is built out of aluminum and does have kind of a slick dark color, which I like. Still has the same connection outputs, 2 DVI HDMI plus DP.
Hey, Ryan.
Yeah.
Did you get any temperature measurements while it was running through gaming and stuff?
I did, on the temperature page.
Okay. Did it make a big difference with the enhanced core design?
It did not.
Good Lord, it did not.
So it ran basically the same temperature as the reference.
Yeah, but the reference is running slower, right?
Yes. So this it's running at the same temperature while it's overclocked. So the custom cooler on this card wasn't really that impressive to me because its sound levels, if you look here, are actually a little bit higher than the reference platform. Keeping in mind that the reference 770s are built on the same cooler that the 780 and the Titan used, and that's a really high-end design. And I don't think that these reference 770s are going to be around for very long. Like, it was kind of, they just needed them to get them out the door and get these cards into people's hands. So it's not like when you take a retail AMD card and compare it to a reference design, where like the reference 7970 is a really loud cooler. The reference 770, GTX 770, is actually a really good cooler. So these numbers are still pretty good from Galaxy. And like I said, the temperatures are still, again, it's running overclocked, but it's actually 1 degree C, or just about the same as the reference design. And keep in mind that with GPU Boost 2, it's actually targeting stuff based on temperature, not on clock speed, not on power consumption. So by default, all the 770s, 780s, anything that uses GPU Boost 2.0, Titan, will try to hit that 80 C mark as often as possible, as much as possible, not go over it and not stay under it if it has thermal headroom and clock headroom.
No. That might actually work against some cooling configurations. Water cooling, for example, once you slap a water cooler on a video card, usually even under heavy load, it'll usually stay between 50 and 60, because even though the GPUs run hot, it's not as hard to cool them as it is a CPU, because they're
If it's running 50 or 60, it's going to push the clocks up as high as it can until it hits another limit, whether it be power limitations or, I guess that's it, right? So yeah. It's either, it's going to try to clock itself as high as it can anyway.
What did you see the boost clocks get to on this? Because I've been watching my testing, and even though it says, it's got a 1056 base clock, it can go up to 1085 boost, but when you're actually looking at the actual clock while it's running, even if it's at the base clock, mm-hmm. and you haven't set any kind of overage,
right?
I still was seeing like 1130, 1140.
This one was running over 12. I think I saw 1202, 1208 clock speeds on it, and that's one of the things that makes testing these NVIDIA graphics cards a little bit
frustrating,
more difficult, because there is variance, right? So. And if you run it in a system versus an open air design, and if the whole case is heating up after an hour, you may see your average clock speed in that game at the same scene kind of a little bit lower than you would otherwise. So it does make it a little bit more complex in testing. But we work with what we can, and we do the testing that we can, and it's we put everything on an even. A playing field, at least on the NVIDIA side of things.
Because it's so horrible to test $400 video cards that have been sent to you.
See, for me, it's still work. It's fun, but it's still work.
It is.
It's cool. The Galaxy GC card is actually a really good card. Even better, it's overclocked and it's still running. It's still going to cost you $399, which is the reference clock, or the reference speed price tag as well. So you're not paying any more for this separate cooler and higher clock speeds. So you can get those at Newegg and Amazon and all that kind of stuff. And if you want to see all the benchmarks, check out the review. It's at this wonderful website called
PCPer.com.
PCPer. Josh Tech Reviews.
Yes, Josh Tech Reviews.
JoshTechReviews.com/.
:8080.
Perspective. :8080.
Hey, just before we go into that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you like how big video cards are getting?
Big physically?
Yeah, because remember this one from last year? This is the MSI Lightning HD 79. I mean, here's it compared to my head.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of big.
Which
well, so
this, is, this is the one that I was trying to get out of the test machine. This is that GTX 780 from Asus, and as you can see, it's just as large.
So,
and one, go ahead.
I will say that like the reference 780 and Titan are not any bigger than the reference like 680. So, which is not any bigger really than the reference 580. So I think the vendors are doing unique things, trying to stand out, different coolers. Bigger is always better. But even Asus rolled back from like three-slot designs, right, to two slots again?
Yeah, they're, so they're wider, but not necessarily longer. Now, something else to compare it to. This is a 19... Let's get back here. It's a 1999 motherboard. Yeah.
By weight, I'm guessing the GPU.
That's pretty awesome, actually.
They've gotten large.
That's what. No, she didn't say that.
Yeah.
So let's get to some news items for this week. First of all, if you did not see the live stream today with Lee Garbutt and myself, Jeremy, we reminisced about about
yes,
the
thank
first
you for
podcast.
Making me feel old this morning at work.
While you were listening to this?
Yeah, so, I did actually fire it up because that's probably the second time I've actually seen Lee's face.
I had to ask him. I was like, "You've never been on the show before, have you?" He's like, "I don't think I've ever been on video." And as we had to, we talked about him being on the very first podcasts and
that was
and then dropping off the face of the earth for a while. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, we had Lee here. He's our resident power supply expert. He also does cases and cooling, but he's known as the power supply expert. He was one of the first in the industry to really take power supply testing seriously, and it has worked to our benefit, and he's done a lot of good work here. We did a stream today where we did learn about power supplies with Ryan and Lee, and it was an amazing, fun event where he brought in a lot of props. He brought in so this is funny, that the one he's holding is a 240-watt power supply. The one I'm holding is a 240-watt power supply. The difference is the one I'm holding is a linear power supply, which I had never seen before, and it weighs 20 pounds. It is heavy as hell, and it was interesting to talk about how they transitioned from non-switching to switching power supplies, what that actually meant. We talked about the designs of power supplies, the different form factors, what active power correction is, active power factor, right? Power factor correction, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about whether or not you should look for a single rail versus a multi-rail, whether or not you want to get a system that I totally blanked on. Oh, well, how much wattage you need in a power supply, how much percentage you need to be over perhaps what your components are actually required to look for. And then we did a little walkthrough of one of his favorite power supplies at the time, this Seasonic platform. And we walked through all the different components of it, what is doing what, and how it all works. It's actually,
you plug the power in there, you
and you can tell the difference between
and off,
the PSU reviewer in that
in
video.
Between.
Ryan is fondling everything with his fingers.
Yeah.
Lee touches nothing except with the pen.
Yeah, no. I greasy oil, none of that bothers me at all. And then we talked about his test bed.
The starched cap.
Oh, well, yeah. Surely it's been unplugged for a while. We went over his test bed here. We talked about all the load. It's not load testers. It's, I don't know, the devices that put a load onto the power supply, how it works, how the noise testing works, how the temperature testing works. And he comes from a very scientific background. He built this, right, when we didn't have enough juice to test 1,500-watt power supplies. He built two of these, just to add into our wattage testing capability. And it was a really, really good event. And then on top of that, EVGA was kind enough to donate a pair of power supplies we gave away during the live stream as well. So if you missed it, you missed out on your chance to win a 1,000-watt or 750-watt power supply from EVGA. But the good news is you can still go watch the replay of this on YouTube or on our website and learn stuff. It's an hour and 15 minutes, and I will bet anybody, even the people that are reviewing power supplies at other websites, I don't know, that you will learn stuff if you watch this video from him, because he really knows what he's talking about, and he's very good at explaining it. along the same lines as well. So that is Learn About Power Supplies with Ryan and Lee. Check it out on PC Perspective.
So it's just not good enough anymore to measure how long the cables are, how loud it sounds, and look in the BIOS to see what the voltages are doing?
I don't think so.
Don't forget the weight, Josh. The weight's always
yeah,
important.
Yeah, it's a heavy power supply. It's got to be in good quality.
Weight can be indicative of quality of a power supply.
There are four screws to secure it to the chassis.
One,
there is a 80-millimeter fan
three,
on the bottom of this.
Four. We also talked about, just so we know, Alan's not on the episode, but we talked about arc welding. And I said, if I can get a power supply, we might have to do a video of this.
He said though that there wasn't enough amperage. I think like you could like the 1500 watts, you could get barely enough amperage to get it to run, but you'd have a hard time keeping it going or something. I mean, I don't.
Yeah,
know
he was worried about the integrity of the arc at 12 volt.
That's it. Yep.
Yeah, I just want to see it happen. You got to try it. It would make a good YouTube video. Don't you believe arc welding with your power supply?
Yes.
Okay.
You should do arc weld thermite. That would be classic.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Let's get something that goes at 4,000 degrees very, very quickly.
Let's talk about some other news. Intel launching new BGA processors, three new Bay Trail chips in Q4, and three Haswell CPUs in 2014. Jeremy, did you take a look at this roadmap update?
To an extent, yeah. And one of the things to pull out of this is, hey, Atom's got a new name. Because the Atoms, in a way, they're sort of being rebranded.
Oh, boy.
As, you know, Pentiums and Celerons.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. Atom has it is a good a idea. Really good.
Yes?
I didn't. Name recognition?
There you go. Yep. There you go.
No, that's a negative reputation. Sorry. Jeez.
Have another
didn't
beer.
They play a similar trick with another line of processors? Like they rebranded something else, and this was a few years ago. They rebranded something else as Pentium.
Well, they took like core, like second generation core processors, and they just disabled a bunch of crap, and they ended up creating like the Pentium D965. Is that a thing?
Yes,
I think that was a part, right?
Something like that. Anyways.
Yeah. Something like that. Yes, they have renamed it, and now they've taken it a couple of steps lower into the Atom line, into the Bay Trail. I'm not gonna say that. Bay Trail looks like it will be an interesting product.
It certainly does.
But I think their branding idea here is kind of dumb. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I mean, Atom's got a really bad rep. Not even just in the enthusiast community, but people have actually remember those, you know, little tiny
netbooks.
Yes, well, netbooks for sure, or all-in-one systems, which were about the same size as a modem. And they just got horrible, horrible name recognition because they were awful. They were flat out awful. But Bay Trail, on the other hand, doesn't look too bad. So you put Pentium and Celeron, two very recognizable names, and people are going to sort of give it a try again. And, I mean, they're all... the one Pentium is a 2.4 gigahertz part with four cores. None of them have multi-threading, of course. Mm-hmm. But they've got Intel HD graphics built into them.
Right.
So it is going to make a big difference. The two Celerons are clocked at 2.0 with four cores, and then the J1750 is 2.4 gigahertz, so slightly faster and a slightly lower model number than the other Celeron, but it's only got two cores.
Right, and these are 10-watt TDP parts.
Yes, these are, you know, not
these are all
going to take
Silvermont, right?
No, these, Silvermont-based Bay Trail parts.
Yes.
Did you see that leak that came out, the other Silvermont, where they compared a 1.46 gigahertz Silvermont to a 1.5 gigahertz Kabini?
I did not, actually.
Yeah, Kabini slapped it around, except on, like, maybe two tests.
Hmm, I would like to see that link.
Interesting.
Maybe somebody should write about it on a website that does news.
Nah.
All right.
Come on, I've been busy, man. You don't know my
losing
life.
Losing your glasses.
I've been looking for them for the past 78 hours straight.
See. All right, fair enough. Anyway, continue, Jerry.
Well, there's another three coming out. These are the 65-watt TDP Haswell-based ones. This is also where you're going to get your first chance to see the Intel Iris 5200 embedded GPU, which in a way is going to be interesting. And they're coming out with two i5s and an i7. The i7 is going to be the only one that has hyper-threading. The other is just four-core, four-thread. The 4770R will be at 3.2 gigahertz with hyper-threading and a 6-meg cache, which makes it significantly better than the 4670R and 4570R, which have comparable clock speeds, 2.7 gigahertz and 3.0 gigahertz, but only a 4-meg cache. So with the BGA, we're looking at a CPU you were never going to upgrade. It is permanently married to that motherboard. So it's going to be interesting to see the niche that these hit in, but at the same time, it would also be really nice to see what this Iris is, because I remember from what you were talking with Intel in the briefing, Ryan, this is the only chance we're going to get to see those 5200s.
Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. Hey, by the way, here, I just want to point out this ad is actually kind of interesting. EVGA is having their 14th anniversary, I guess it is, and you can win 5,000 EVGA bucks. I just like the fact that they came up with their own monetary.
And if you click on it, we get EVGA pennies.
Yeah, we do not get 5K EVGA bucks, that's for sure.
So you can buy three Titans and a motherboard.
That sounds like a pretty good birthday present to me. Right? How about we talk about... Oh, wait a minute. I wanted to point out something out about that video with Lee and I that we just posted on YouTube right before this thing started. I think this is a good comment that I just got in, that everybody should go watch this. Davey says in the YouTube channel, "This video is fantastic. 30 minutes in and I already feel like an expert. Good stuff." So there you go.
And that's the last we heard of him, because he electrocuted himself right after watching the video.
He opened it up. He started touching things again. It was weird. Microsoft cuts the price of non-Pro Surface tablets. So that would be Windows RT-based tablets. While I purchased them for $500, $600, $700, they are now selling for $350 for the Windows RT. This is the Tegra 3-powered Surface tablet. It's actually the physical form factor is good. The device is good. I have questions about I have questions about the viability of it as a platform, not being able to run x86 applications, but looking like Windows. But if you're interested in that kind of device, something that maybe is going to replace an iPad for some productivity uses, for $350, it's a pretty good buy, I think.
That doesn't include the dock, though.
It does not include the keyboard, no.
But it comes with free Office.
It does come with Office for free. Yes. That's right.
And also with that pricing, supposedly they have student pricing that's even less than $350. I want to say $200, but don't quote me on that. But I know it's less than $350 for the student pricing on that.
Maury, you're not a student.
Well, actually, I am.
Don't say that online, Ryan.
I still have my UKY.edu email address as well, everybody. If we switch from the world of low-power tablets and go to the world of really high power processors, and by power I mean power consumption, the AMD FX 9000 series is apparently now available, and it's available from quite a few system retailers. This post that Jeremy put up, where were they available from? This one is, let's see, you've got
Origin, you've got Velocity Micro, CyberPower,
Puget.
Yes, Puget Sound has them.
Yep. On the CyberPower ones, they were available as an upgrade, though I don't think they actually had base systems with them. It just looked like that you could spec a system out with a lower clock 9000 series and then upgrade to the big bad 5 gigahertz if you wanted to.
Gotcha.
Yeah, every single one of them were like that. That I saw, it was, I mean, if you don't spend much time with a system builder, and frankly a lot of our viewers just don't do the boutique computers because they want to build them themselves,
right?
The quoted price when you first land on that page is not going to be for the 9590, and it's definitely not for the 9590 overclocked before it gets to you. On the other hand, for people that really just want a fully functional computer that has a warranty that they don't have to worry about, you know, They're happy to pay two thirds again the price that
I'd
we would just buying parts.
What I find interesting about this this kind of launch that happened yesterday. It was kind of a surprise. We knew about it like a day in advance, but apparently people have seen like these available in a retail box, right? Is that right? Like you've been able to buy like a 95.90? I think we saw let me get out of here and go to Amazon. I think we saw the AMD FX 9590 for sale. Where was it at, Ken? Of course, now it doesn't show up.
Okay.
No, we saw it for sale earlier. It was out of stock, but then there was somebody that was selling it. Yep, down. Last listing. Here it is. AMD FX 9590, temporarily out of stock. Sold by Amazon. $800.14. It's $800.
Yeah.
Haven't seen that in a while from AMD.
God.
Nerp.
Lord.
And apart from the Yo Mama comment in the comments underneath this, people were sort of saying, oh, look, we can charge $1,500 for a system, so we must be every bit as good as Intel. Put together one of the Intel systems in one of those, their AMD is still sitting $1,000 cheaper than they are, unless you go with the absolute bottom i5 processor.
Right. Here's what confused me about that is when I met with AMD at E3, they were very specifically told me that this was going to be a system vendor only product. Very specific about that because, well, it uses a lot of power. We want to make sure that people are using the right motherboards for it because you have to have a good motherboard for it. You have to have good cooling for it. We don't want to just put it out in the market and, you know, have warranty issues. So something around the – imagine this. They didn't tell us about it. Problem one, right? The indication one that there may be a problem with performance. I did see a I think somebody had a review earlier that I looked at today from Kit Guru. That looked at the performance of the 9590 against like the 3770 and the 4770, and it was not good.
No.
And it used like 160 watts more power under a load.
But you can cook breakfast and game at the same time. How is this not a feature?
Like, or heat your entire house during the winter in Michigan.
And the thing is I really – like I'm looking for a processor from AMD to trump it. Like I want a processor from AMD to say, hey, look – it's not the best, but it's pretty good, and here's why. So it bothers me that that they would not kind of seed the normal people with these parts. I haven't seen reviews of this kind of in any kind of widespread view. And I did request a system from one of their partners as well, so we'll see. I mean, what I'm afraid I'm going to get is something like this.
$450.
Yeah,
I could maybe understand this, but $800 is kind of crazy.
Here's
$450 is still pretty extreme.
Yeah,
but. Yeah, 800.
Can you? So if it doesn't beat the performance of a 3770 or a 4770K, can you charge more than that? Do you feel like that AMD would be justified saying, well, our performance is not up to the 3770 or 4770, but we are going to ask you for 20% more than that?
Yeah, it's kind of strange and perhaps not fair, but you know what? I don't know how many of these chips they're going to have. Obviously, some OEM or SI had a bunch, and they're like, we're not going to sell all these things. So let's go to Amazon and cut out all the other crap, just sell it as $800
part. I thought I saw a retail box for it. Like,
there is no retail box for it.
Let me look real quick. Just because. Oh, wait. Hardware Canucks, do they have one? Went up July 15th. No, it doesn't have a retail box. But they have a review.
Said Kit Guru, according to Arbiter, Kit Guru has a review of it also.
Yeah, the Kit Guru one was the one I saw earlier.
Wasn't a retail box. It was just... Yeah.
No, here it is.
Wait, what?
$95.90.
I take it back.
No, that's not a retail box. It's one of those.
It's got a sticker on it.
It's a small OEM box that is like this thick, and the Xeons.
Okay.
Besides, it would have to ship with.
No,
water.
Wait. Here it is. Xeons. You're right. Here's that box right there.
Yeah. There you go. That's not retail. Yeah.
Okay. That's their non-retail box that they send it to SIs and OEMs.
Huh. Interesting. So apparently, Josh, you pissed people off at AMD because they didn't want to send this one.
I did.
Apparently. Because it sure wasn't me.
No, it can't be you. It
wouldn't be me. Couldn't possibly.
You and your damn witchcraft-like frame rating.
I know. It's magic I pulled from the sky. Yes. Let's talk about happier things, like old dying hardware. Josh, you posted a hardware flashback for us.
Good Lord, did I really do that?
You did.
P2B or not to P2B?
Flashback to when you wrote it.
Flashback. You know, I had held this up earlier when I compared the modern video card to it. The modern video card was very close in size, which is kind of funny. But yeah, this is one of Asus's first 440BX-based chips, boards. Back when everybody else was going to jumperless configurations, Asus still had jumpers. And not only that, but if you remember back the time, and you probably don't, maybe Maury does, but a lot of them were shipping products that had a buffer chip and four DIMM slots. And the buffer chip essentially allowed them to have, you know, a greater amount of memory. And it was kind
of a crappier amount of performance.
What's that?
And a crappier amount of performance.
Yes, you would get some insane amount of performance hit in memory operations, like to the tune of 20%. And at first it was really kind of fun to have all that, you know, those four memory DIMMs that you could populate. But when they started to benchmark it, you took a major hit with these buffer chips. So Asus created this one with only three DIMMs, didn't need the buffer, faster performance. Four PCI slots, and this is just amazing. Who would have thought you'd still see three ISA ports? One for the modem, one for the sound card, and then one for the SCSI card for your scanner.
Oh, Lord,
which,
help us.
Of course, because the first PCI slot shared IRQs with AGP, you couldn't really use that one. So you were left with two PCI slots to put your two Voodoo 2s on. And you had a full board.
So yeah, because you could not use those other two PCIs if you filled up the ISAs.
Exactly. You couldn't use the bottom one because they shared the external slot.
That's right. ISAs went up. That's right. I forgot.
Yep. Yep.
Computers in the old days were dumb.
Yo, ATA33 for the win.
And don't forget the IRQ conflicts.
How could I ever forget?
Yeah, and this didn't even have integrated sound. It just had two serial ports, two crappy USB, because apparently BX chipsets had USB problems.
Yeah, okay.
But at least Josh, you know your AGP port worked.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
If you want to hear something funny, a lot of the super high-end boards actually have not jumper blocks, but they have the little dip switch blocks now that allow you to enable and disable PCIe slots for better overclocking.
Nice.
I see your comments
here.
That
was our hardware flashback. I posted some other minutiae.
You did. I was reading like the Voodoo 3 was essentially a PCI 66 megahertz device in the AGP slot because of some compatibility issues.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was compatibility issues or they just wanted to do it that way. That's what it came out to be.
And if you didn't do it Intel's way, it was not going to work very well.
Sideband Andra.
Can you believe that they would have
ever been the last time you heard about that?
Well, right now.
Long time. Okay.
All right. You also... Wait. Did you post something else?
Well, yeah, but... Do you want to talk about Alan's stuff first or me with Intel?
I'll talk about Alan because it won't take very long.
Okay.
Alan, everybody. That's it. So Alan is in Seoul, Korea, as you can see here, based on his just clever as hell initial line to this news post. So he's in there visiting with Samsung about their SSD stuff. He's covering the 2013 Samsung Global SSD Summit. And they are apparently releasing a new unit called the 840 Evo. It will push 10-nanometer class flash, promises increased write speeds by 2 to 3x over the 840, and will be available in capacities as high as 1 terabyte. So that's so many GBs we're into the TBs. Tuberculosis is not... It's not what we're... It's not one tuberculosis.
Hey, it's coming from Korea.
Well, you know. So that's all the information we have for now, is that they were announcing it. Alan says that he will have a review for us later, probably early next week would be my guess. He's attempting to VNC into his testing machine at home while his girlfriend sets up the hardware. I don't imagine this is going to work out swimmingly, so I will probably have to wait for him to return home to get an actual review of this product, but he's trying his best, I know. So the 840 Evo, and I'm sure there's going to be other things he's going to learn about that we'll be able to talk about next week when he gets back. So that is that's what's happening in Korea with Alan.
Way to go, Alan.
Right now. So tell me about Scrooge McDuck.
Scrooge McDuck. You know, Intel released their quarterly results today.
Money!
And they didn't quite do as well as analysts had hoped. Well, but
Scrooge looks happy.
Well, you know what? They still came out $2 billion ahead this quarter.
All right.
Let's compare that to pretty much every other tech corporation in the world
like
that had a bad quarter. Like who?
Yeah, hell, over the year?
Yeah. I mean, AMD, I think, results are tomorrow or the day after?
All right.
They're not expecting nearly $2 billion in net income. So, yeah, they had $12.8 billion in revenue. And that was down, I think, from last year, like $13.2 billion. Last year was a really good year. It was probably one of their last really good years in terms of PC sales, because as we've heard so much lately, the PC sales have been going down. And it's because of smartphones, tablets, and...
Haven't heard of them.
I know. And not only that, but people who have CPUs from 4 years ago still are able to pretty much run everything out there that they could want and not have to upgrade like they had in years past. And so we're seeing a real slowdown of the PC market. It's definitely saturated. Again, tablets, cell phones, smaller devices like this, those are obviously selling well. And Intel was pretty much slow on the draw in getting into the mobile space. I mean, they attempted it with Atom, with the netbooks, but they never did anything except some basic upgrades through the years, and they weren't very aggressive with it. They always used a slightly older process node for these products. And, yeah, they sold. They had okay margins. They kept the percentage of market share up there, but they were never really great products that people really wanted. And that's kind of changing around now, obviously. Silvermont and Bay Trail. Well, Silvermont is essentially going to populate the Bay Trail products. It's a lot better architecture. It's going to be on the 22-nanometer node. It's going to be much more competitive. Right now, I think Intel has three or four cell phone wins with their current Z series of Atom. Not that many products shipped. But Silvermont should give them a boost in there, and this is something that's really important long-term for Intel, because, again, it's not like the PC market is necessarily shrinking. It certainly has slowed down dramatically, and people are just not buying PCs like they used to. So server market is going into all kinds of different directions. I mean, we've got, you know, the ARM guys offering stuff. We've got a lot of Blade things, AMD and their C-Micro purchase. I mean, it's really becoming not so much disjointed, but very spread out, in that the one-size-fit-all Xeon is not really appropriate anymore for a lot of the workloads that they're finding that, you know, our modern connected society actually uses. So Intel is still, again, they've done well this month, this quarter. They're still the largest x86 CPU manufacturer in the world. They're starting to get into mobile. They have some interesting things coming on. But even Crystal in a Forest? Bad quarter, what's that?
Crystal Forest?
What one's that?
Oh, Intel's for networking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's looking interesting. They aren't seeing any revenues from it yet, but you know, pushing ARM and PowerPC and them out of the networking environment, especially after owning McAfee and trying to get antivirus on the silicon.
Yeah,
it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, Crystal on the silicon and McAfee—that doesn't sound good.
no, the software is going to work amazing. You don't understand.
Yes.
But you'll never be able to remove it.
Oh, yeah. Because now it's in the chip.
Keep putting more crystals in because it'll...
otherwise, it'll move to Belize. And...
Yeah, McAfee. But yeah, they still came out $2 billion ahead. They still had good sales. They're expecting flat revenue throughout the rest of this year. So certainly they're going to see an increase in both Q3 and Q4. But overall, the yearly is going to be flat as compared to last year. So it's a little disappointing from them. They like growth. They've seen a tremendous amount of growth over the past 15 years. So I guess eventually any market is going to become saturated. And certainly with the way Sandy Bridge, Ivy Bridge, and now Haswell, you don't see very many reasons to really upgrade computers like you used to. I mean, back in 2006, if you had a computer from 2001, I mean, it's an order of magnitude faster than, you know, what you had.
Oh, yeah.
Or what's available now.
Yeah.
But now you look at a computer you built in 2010 and compare it to what you have, it's not nearly as dramatic. Certainly, in some workloads, it's going to be an impressive amount, but people just don't see the need to upgrade. And, you know, Intel's trying to move into different markets. And, you know, I guess I wish them the best of luck, but it's a crowded market. And you got guys like Qualcomm, Samsung, Apple, who have just millions and millions of processors that they're selling all the time. It's going to be a hard market for them to break into.
Alrighty. Before we get into our hardware software picks of the week, I want to make sure, I guess this will be our second to last podcast before QuakeCon. And I want to bring up a couple of things here. I was working on a post today. I got sidetracked. I'll try to have it up tomorrow. We're going to be at QuakeCon. Our workshop is on Saturday. It's a little bit earlier this year. It's at 12:30 p.m. So you have to get up out of bed before noon to get in line or to start setting up. Sorry, Ken. It's going to be at the main stage again, where we have started to get our prizes and prize listings in, and it's going to be pretty dramatic again this year. Expect to see a lot of people there. We are going to have T-shirts. We're going to have lots of prizes. We're going to have Tom Peterson from NVIDIA has already promised to be up there. It looks like we might have some overclocking demonstrations from EVGA possibly as well. We're working on some other things too. We're working on T-shirts. We're working on... possibly.
Have you mentioned T-shirts?
T-shirts. Everybody loves T-shirts. T-shirts? T-shirts? Shirts?
Hoodies. Hoodies.
No, they're too expensive. And you live in Texas. Mm.
Snuggies?
So I'm going to run this by. We'll say it publicly. Like, we're thinking about on Wednesday night recording a podcast at the hotel. And the events lady for the Hilton Anatole has been nice enough to give us a room to do all of our pre-show stuff in. And it's big enough that we could probably host 50 people, 50 or 60 people in there if they wanted to come in and watch us do the show. Maybe there will be two or three of you that actually want to do that. If so, you know, hit me up on Twitter or something like that. Let me know. If people are interested in it, we may do that. And then afterwards, go to the bar and get a couple of drinks and hang out and that kind of stuff. If that's something that people are interested in. Because even though we have the workshop, I always feel bad because we have all these fans that are there and they all come up and try to say hi to me. And then we've got to rush out of the room and go, you know, disperse things and pack things and set things back up. And I never really get to hang out and kind of talk with people and hear their complaints about Josh in person and, you know, work on all that stuff. So,
hey, Ryan.
Yes, sir.
Ryan, the only caveat to that is that you may get less people depending on when Wednesday night admission is, because you can – Wednesday night drop-off varies from anywhere from like 3 p.m. to shoot, it's been as late as 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning.
We'll have to play it by ear. I think there's a lot of that. And we also were thinking about maybe doing it on Thursday instead. I don't know. We'll see. We'll have to see when we get there Wednesday morning what the schedule looks like and that kind of stuff. So if you're interested, let me know, and we'll see about doing something where people can come in and watch us, maybe ask some questions and make fun of us, and then have a couple drinks or something. So that it will be coming soon, and I'll have information on that on our workshop page when that goes up. So hardware software picks of the week. Here is my software pick is stamps.com. And not because they're an advertiser, but because I bought $900-something worth of postage today on stamps.com.
Not because it's a good piece of software.
I mean, because it's a crappy piece of software. It's like looks like it has the animations, like when you go to purchase new postage, is like the AOL animation, like you're sending the email where it folds itself up and goes into the
You look like you're writing a letter.
Yeah. So
at least it doesn't make a bad sound, and it like has a person running and then meeting other people. Do you remember that AOL?
It doesn't do that. No, I don't. No. But it doesn't do that. So what were we shipping? We were finally getting, we have all in bags, all with labels on them, our shirts from the Indiegogo project. This is what we sent to people, including Jeremy's mom.
It's nice.
What's on the back? What's in the bag?
Nothing.
Anything?
Actually.
Oh, okay.
See? What do you see? Is there anything there?
Lint.
Lint. There better not be lint. So this is the shirt. It's fluorescent green. If you wear it at QuakeCon, I'll be able to spot you. I don't know what that means, but I'll be able to spot you. So I imagine there'll be a handful of you there. So we've got those sent out. We're working on all the other stuff as well. If you donated and you wanted to enable ad-free version of the site, chances are that's already on. If that's not, send me a note. And it was a lot more work than I expected to get 200 T-shirts. Printed, bagged, labeled, addressed, purchased, whatever you want to do. So that was my pick. Stamps.com. Not the best software, but better than licking envelopes and stamps. So who's up? Jeremy?
Yeah, Ken's tongue really thanks you for that, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, it
oh,
is.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so I had almost nothing this week, but there was a Kickstarter project that successfully went and is now in production that I totally missed, but it is a way to add an electro-permanent magnet to a quadcopter. So this is right up your alley, Alan, or since you've got one now, Ryan.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's fairly lightweight. It requires almost no electricity. They're talking about an electro-permanent magnet is either non-magnetized or magnetized, and it's just a matter of, in this case, kicking like 40 milliamps to it to magnetize it or demagnetize it.
What
so
do I do with
you
it?
Can literally fly your quadcopter over to something metallic, pick it up, fly it over to you, and drop it off. And really, who would not want to do that?
Are there any beers that are in metallic?
Aluminum is not magnetic.
It's non-metallic.
No, I understand that. Are there any beers in steel cans?
No.
Not that I know of. But
out probably okay to drink.
Ken wants to know if kegs could be lifted by my quadcopter.
No. Not singly, but if you got enough of them together, you might be able to do that.
Yeah, and you'd get about 5 feet, and then it would drop because they'd all be out of battery power.
Oh, they're talking about a good 10 kilo maximum for the magnet. Of course, the quadcopter is not going to be able to lift 10 kilo.
Oh no!
But you loop enough of them together, and hey, could happen.
All right, Josh, what do you got?
Me, you know, sometimes you just need a memory card reader. So I got this IO Gear.
That's deep talk, man.
It's a USB 3.0 version, and it's nice, shiny black, and it just works. And it's not terribly expensive. And have I mentioned it works? And it's USB 3.0. And it's pretty quick.
I remember when we got our first USB 3.0 card reader, and it changed my life forever.
Forever.
This is when we were recording stuff to our 7D. And using it for video, it looks so good. It's so big. All right, $28. IO Gear GFR 381 USB 3.0 Super Speed Multi Card Reader Writer. All right, Maury, you're last.
Yeah, I'm gonna geek out on you guys a bit. This is something that I picked up from a QuickCon builder, Monsoon. Well, I can't really see it too good. Well, shoot,
I've got a picture here.
Yeah, but here you can smell. Okay. Yeah, see, they're water barbs. They're really nice. They're, you can get them in, I think they offer about three or four different colors. I picked
Wait, did
the
you
red
say they're water
ones.
Bongs?
No, water barbs.
Water bongs?
Barbs. B-A-R-B-S. They're chrome, though. The ones I got were red chrome because they fit with my build. But they offer in black chrome, flat black.
That's pretty awesome, actually.
Gray chromed. They have, you know, it includes a tool. You can basically put them in without having to use any kind of wrench at all. You know, it comes with a custom wrench that you can basically put them in and take them out so you don't mar the surface of them. And you're just all around very well constructed. They come with extra washers and everything else. You know, they're good. They are high end. They are a little costly. But if you're going for a certain look with a build, you know, they can really make or break a build.
Do you find the coolest things, Maury? Stuff that I would never have any idea existed, or that I may not ever want.
Cool, maybe not cool.
All right, so that is our podcast for this week. Alan will be back with us next week. I'm going to be on a kind of vacation next week, but I'm probably still going to be on the show because I'll be trying to avoid my family. So we'll figure all that as we go. And don't forget again, QuakeCon, August 1st to the 4th. Our workshop is on Saturday, August the 3rd, 12:30 p.m. at the main stage. We want you guys there to join us. We love people that listen to the podcast come up and say hi, say thanks, or shut up, or whatever it is you want to do. We're open to any kind of feedback. PCPro.com/podcast is the URL I would like you to share with people. If you think we're interesting, or you think the stuff we talk about is at least somewhat interesting, I mean, share that URL, post it, you know, spray paint it on walls and stuff, whatever is necessary. And then pcpro.com/live if you want to watch us record the show. We do it Wednesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Pacific. And you can also check pcpro.com. On the right-hand side, we have our upcoming schedule of events right here. It's on every page, PC Perspective Upcoming Events. It says we're live right now. That's how you know. You can actually see the upcoming schedule of things that are coming up soon. And then you can click this link right here. It says get notified when we go live. And you click that. It takes this page and you put in your name and your email address. And we sign you up for a mailing list that when we have special events, we send the email out and say, hey, tomorrow we're going to do this. Set your calendar. And then we also kind of will usually send it out 10 or 15 minutes before we actually start the stream too, especially if it's a unique thing that is not a regular weekly occurrence, like our podcast. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. Really appreciate it. We'll be back next week with another episode. I'm Ryan Schrout.
I'm Jeremy Hellstrom.
I'm Josh Walrath.
And I'm Maury Tittleman.
Bye.
Good night.